The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Joanna Dimmers is the guest this week, and she will be presenting a workshop on musicology, fiction, and experiential judgment on March 13th at 3 p.m. Pacific Time. So this interview with Joanna Dimmers, author of Drone and Apocalypse, is a precursor to that workshop. My name is Douglas Lane. It's March 8th. It's the day of the women's strike, or the woman's strike. And I'm the host of this podcast and the publisher of Zero Books. I want to thank all the Zero Books Club members and encourage you to join. You would be getting access to this upcoming workshop. That's the March 13th, 3 p.m. musicology workshop with Joanna Dimmers. And also you'll be getting access to tomorrow's workshop with Andy Marshall and I on Hartin Negri's Empire. Right now you're listening to Enmesh Vaporwave, but in just a moment you'll be listening to Joanna Dimmers and I discuss musicology. Joanna Dimmers is Associate Professor of Musicology at the University of Southern California's Thornton School of Music, and you teach courses on post-World War II popular and experimental music and aesthetics. And you've published and are publishing a book with us, Anatomy of Thought Fiction is Coming, and Drone and Apocalypse was the book that you published before. I'm really glad to talk to you. I'm really glad that you're going to be doing a workshop for the Zero Books Club members in March about musicology. It's one that I feel like I'm looking forward to sitting in on because, you know, I like music. Everyone, I think, likes some sort of music. But I don't know enough about musicology. And I'm especially embarrassed about it, really, because I was an employee of the Oregon Symphony for 20 years and never really did study musicology or learn much about classical music in any formal way. So I'm looking forward to it. Not that you're going to teach about classical music, per se. Mm-hmm. But tell me about what you're planning on doing with the workshop, and tell me, I guess maybe start with, what is musicology?
Musicology is, well, at its most basic, it's the study of music, obviously. It's a discipline that has its roots in at least 19th century, if not 18th century, Enlightenment thought that basically proposed a project of finding out all the factual information we could about music. It's a discipline that has a great deal of historical connections to German universities, and Musikwissenschaft, which is the German word for musicology, was basically exclusively focusing on German classical composers. So if we go back far enough, musicology is also kind of a tool of nationalist history of intellectualism. You know, so let's go back and let's study that which makes our own art form music so great.
Okay, so there's a bit of Eurocentrism in musicology as a form or as a mode of study. Is that right?
Well, sure. I mean, for many decades, it was explicitly Eurocentric. And then, especially in the 80s, with the advent of what's called new musicology, what used to be called new musicology, now it's often referred to as critical musicology. Musicologists like Susan McClary opened that paradigm wide open, mm-hmm. and proposed that we not only talk about classical music, but talk about popular music. Also that we not strictly focus on the factual things we can know about music, but what music means, especially to listeners, not only to experts and not only to composers. Now, I just want to break in. I don't want to get off topic, but I also want to say that there is another discipline that for several decades kind of developed in parallel to musicology called ethnomusicology. And I am not an ethnomusicologist. I don't purport to have any expertise in that discipline because I wasn't trained in it. But ethnomusicology for a long time was basically the discipline for people who didn't want to focus on classical music. It was often associated with anthropology, and it relied more on ethnographical methods. So going out in the field, interviewing, recording.
Yeah, you were present there because I was just about to ask you about anthropology. I was going to suggest that if you were someone who didn't want to study music from a Western perspective, from a Eurocentric perspective, but you were in the, you know, in the West, that you might be tempted by anthropological studies of music. But it seems like, I guess the problem there is if you're taking an anthropological approach to studying music, including Western European music, that you're using a non-musical, non-art-focused approach, that you're starting from the paradigm, a different Western paradigm, some postmodernist heretics would say, called science, to study humanity as an abstract, as if you could sort of step out of whatever specific human position you were in and study humans like you would study apes or bees or any other animal, I suppose.
For a long time, that was a criticism that musicologists would use to kind of defend their approach, was that, if we're going to be talking about music, we should be talking about the stuff of music, not necessarily who listens to it or who makes it or the social implications of it. Again, I'm just kind of bringing up these, for the most part, really dated critiques. Because today, what's very interesting is that musicologists, so Western classical music musicologists, more and more often drawing from ethnomusicological approaches. More of them, for instance, are arguing that classical music should be treated as a case study in the same way as Aboriginal Australian music or, music from Imperial Japan. It's just one other particular moment in place and time that we can study.
Now, what would be the difficulty with that position? I mean, that doesn't seem to me to be a very controversial position. Mm-hmm. But what would the refutation of that argument be?
I still think there are many people out there who like to believe that classical music embodies the best in humanity. It because of its supposed complexity or the word that Shankelevich uses, ineffability. Not that Shankelevich would necessarily be against talking about classical music as one more social group to study, but I think there are many people who are hung up on the prestige of classical music, and they would like to regard it as a self-contained art form whose meaning does not have to have recourse to society or to history or to culture.
Oh, okay. All right. So those two things seem a little different to me because it seems like you could easily claim, yeah, we've done a survey of music internationally, historically, we've compared Aboriginal music to European classical music, and using the same criteria for both that we developed in the sciences, we've determined that, you know, using these criteria, say complexity and, I don't know, what other kinds of, you know, harmonics or whatever criteria you might want to use, that, yes, the European classical tradition is, in these ways, superior. And without it being, without treating it differently than you would treat the Aboriginal, as long as you had the kind of universal set of criteria, and then those criteria would have to be questioned. But
sure. Yeah.
But then the second thing was that argument where you were saying, no, you can't judge classical music by scientific standards. You can't judge European classical music is as important a way of understanding the world as the scientific method is, basically. Is that the argument?
I think that's part of it. Repeatedly, there's been the claim that classical music has transcendence, and that supposedly is what makes it relevant today, the way it was relevant 200 years ago. And we can probably all agree that the scientific method is anything but concerned with transcendence, and it's perhaps concerned with positive data that can be replicated in experimental situations, but never for one moment would it make the argument that we can take for granted that something will always be the case. It's very much an empirical, we can take something for granted if we measure it repeatedly and we can see.
So many of the things that otherwise just pass as playing the notes on the page, just a mechanical exercise, how to execute those, how to make sure you're playing in tune. Sometimes that is what musicians think their task is. Don't make mistakes. Make it as beautiful as possible. When you understand the context within which the music was composed, the aesthetic priorities, the sorts of even cultural tensions that are articulated in the music, the ability to perform, I think, rises exponentially. To take something like Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, for instance, we're very accustomed to thinking of the last movement as the Ode to Joy. There is a hymn that many people sing in church services in English that just has the tune. And the use of the Ninth Symphony politically for purposes of celebration, such as the fall of the Berlin Wall, has made people hear that piece in exclusively celebratory terms. Now, in order to hear it that way, you have to ignore a lot of the things that made that piece so difficult to play when it was first performed. It was regarded even as unperformable for quite a long time after the premiere. And it was thought to be that way, not just because of the enormous performing forces that it takes, but also because of the ruptures that take place, because of the really shocking events. We begin the symphony with a dissonance that screams after a very, very placid, beautiful third movement. The scream erupts. Now, we're used to that because we've heard the Ninth Symphony millions of times. We're also accustomed to the fact that as it tries to come to a conclusion, it keeps almost stopping and then breaking down, almost stopping, then breaking down, almost stopping, breaking down, and finally just shoving for conclusion. Now, this is not the way a piece ought to work. And I think when you're able to talk to people who are performing, who are conducting, but even, you know, the person who is playing last chair, second fiddle, to understand the way that Beethoven is trying, in a way, to perform once again the confidence he had in the Enlightenment when he wrote the Eroica Symphony. But he is now riddled with doubt. many things have happened in Europe and in his own life in the course of the intervening years. And so these places where the piece almost falls apart, where it is almost ripped down the middle, are as important as the places where it seems to be completely coherent. It has to be a balance between those, between the rejoicing and the hymn singing and the places where it suddenly breaks off into nowhere with question marks hanging all around. Now, you can perform the Ninth Symphony, and many people do, by trying to push through those question marks, trying to make some kind of smooth entity of the whole movement. And that certainly works well for celebration. But the impact that you can have when you perform the doubt, when you perform the desire, and yet the doubts that this world genuinely still exists, is just extraordinary. And I think anyone going into a performance of a piece that is that complex needs to have ways of thinking about why this movement is shaped so very strangely, or even have it be pointed out to them that the movement is shaped strangely because we're so familiar with it, we don't even notice anymore. I sometimes tell my students who want there to be a single right way of performing a piece of classical music, that is probably the wrong question. There have been hundreds, thousands of productions of Hamlet, each one with a completely different take on that very, very complex text, each one imagining a different motivation for Hamlet, a different motivation for Ophelia. And we go to see productions of Hamlet not because it will duplicate the one that Laurence Olivier did on film, but because it will give us new insights. It will cause us to see not only Hamlet differently, but will allow us to experience our own lives in a different way. And that's what the performance of a great piece of classical music ought to do also. That's why I think that we have to think about what is being said? What is the nature of the meaning of these pieces? And how is that meaning being articulated in the very smallest details of articulation, of bowing, of dynamic marks, or anything else? I think all of these things must be brought together.
That move to of transcendence, or another way to put it would be the move towards universal values, is something that I don't think even the sciences can escape. That you have to have, like, in order to set criteria, you have to have some position from which to judge the criteria. And you have to have some sort of understanding of a universal norm. So, for instance, you know, in the empirical sciences, you have to have the assumption that there's a material world, which we have access to through the senses. You know, this is a universal claim. It's not something that you just experience in a particular moment.
Yeah, and I just as science at least is taking that leap of faith in trying to root observation in our senses. So they take the leap of faith that Descartes, I guess, is opening the door for when he says, well, you know, if I know that I'm thinking, I think the idea about the transcendence of music is that it's transcendent and simultaneously rooted in humanity. It's an immanently human utterance. So it's talking about the human experience. Now, there are, you know, many people who say, well, it also talks about the divine, or it also talks about other things. But the defenses of classical music that I've come across basically say that it is narrating something about us, or it expresses something about us, maybe not narration.
Now, that narration could be the same that could happen in other cultures, and it does. And of course, it did happen in other cultures. Okay, here's a weird question, maybe, or not that weird, but maybe it's an ethnomusicologist question rather than just a musicologist question. But is there such a thing as music that is the same across all cultures? Is music a universal category? Do you know? Is that an empirical question?
I don't know. I mean, if the question is, does music exist in all cultures? I would assume it does, but I don't know.
But that's not quite the same question, is it? Because that would be, from the Western perspective, can we find something we'll call music in all cultures? Is one kind of question. And then the other one is the concept of music, does it exist in all cultures? The science fiction writer with me would say, I can imagine a species that did nothing but create music to communicate, and they might not have a concept of music at all.
Yeah, I see.
You know, so anyway, just to...
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, depending on how loose we want to be with our definition, we can talk about music existing in the animal world as well. Darwin talks quite a bit about the development of bird song and other forms of what we would refer to as musical behavior. But I don't think Darwin at any point tries to claim any sort of aesthetic status for it. It's the use of a particular type of intentional sound production, mostly to attract a mate.
But it seemed like songs to us. Looking over what you're planning to do, and this is something you've taught, this piece you're going to give for the Zero Books readers is something that you've presented before. But the first thing that made me pause was this idea of the ineffable as some sort of foundation for knowledge. And to me, it struck me as something similar to claims that direct experience should be the foundation for certain kinds of knowledge. And from my way of thinking, the kind of one of the clearest refutations for that claim comes from a podcast, because, you know, I get everything from podcasts. And there was a podcast called Radiolab, in which they interviewed, they were investigating the phenomenon called yellow rain. And during, right after the Vietnam War through the 80s, there had been reports of yellow rain in Laos and Vietnam, and the Reagan administration decided that this was actually a biological weapon developed by the Soviets to help the Vietnamese fight in Laos against the young people there. And they interviewed some people who were involved in the resisting the Vietnamese People's Army, who had said that they had been attacked by yellow rain. But there have been new studies done that show that maybe the yellow rain story was a myth, that what people have been experiencing was actually bee feces, and that there was really no direct evidence of any kind of bad health effects from this yellow rain, and that it was mostly a myth. And during the conversation on Radiolab, the people who had supposedly survived these attacks of yellow rain were very offended by these claims from Yale scientists and others that there was no such thing, that was bee feces. But when questioned, did you ever see an airplane dumping the yellow rain? Did you ever see the yellow rain itself directly? You know, they couldn't answer it very convincingly. They kind of crumpled under cross-examination. But they had this ineffable emotional experience of yellow rain that was very important to them. It was part of their narrative of their experience resisting the Vietnam People's Army. So I would just say that there's a problem here, that you could believe in things and have narratives about things and have experiences of things and have very emotional have very strong emotional connections to ideas that aren't true.
Yeah. I think they're connected. They're not precisely the same. The ineffable is basically that which we cannot express in words. So it's not necessarily something which one has to personally live through, but it's something that here's where the similarities to what you were talking about are clear. It's something that one can feel very strongly, but it's just for whatever reason words fail us, and the kind of the big protagonist for the ineffable in music is this French philosopher from the 20th century called Vladimir Jankélévitch. And he wrote quite eloquently about why it is that in so much music, it clearly moves us. But when we try to sit down and talk about why it does, it's difficult. And more than difficult, the more we talk about it, the more we try to pin down music in terms of its what it does to us in words, the more off track we seem to get.
No matter how we use the words, I mean, if we try to, I would think that maybe if you were writing poems in response to music, that maybe that would be, by this theory, a better approach to understanding
sure.
music?
Yeah, yeah. And he even intimates as such. In some of his writings, he talks about that how perhaps the words that we use when we try to know music are the words that fail us. But he distinguishes between gnostic and drastic actions. And drastic ones are the ones that are more actions than just words, just, you know, talking about it. And he champions kind of a drastic approach to music. But, you know, short of advocating that we all go out and write poetry, I think he, you know, he's just at least trying to call our attention to some of the pitfalls of presuming that we can write everything that there is to be known about music.
Well, you know, I'm reminded of, I told you at the start that I'm working on a little video for Zero Books about object-oriented ontology, and Graham Harman, who's a theorist of that school, talks about how we can't understand objects in the world in the usual ways, and that we've made a mistake of either trying to undermine objects by describing what they're composed of, or overmining them by describing where they fit in the world or what they do in the world. And that he would want to move towards the arts in order to develop a different way to understand objects. So is this is this closely related to this notion of the ineffable, do you think?
Yeah, I think it can be. I like what Harman is talking about, and Timothy Morton also goes in this direction quite a bit in talking about particular types of artworks that sort of reflect our experience of hyperobjects, so things that are not only sublime, they exceed their frame, but they might also take place on a time frame different from the one we're used to operating. Morton writes about certain types of recent music or visual art have a capacity to deal with these objects that otherwise would, evade our comprehension. So, yeah, I think Harman and Morton they're both on to something.
Now, is this an anti-systemic approach to understanding? Is it an intuitive approach to understanding?
I would say probably. I'm a little nervous about committing to that word and then, you know, finding out later.
Well, that's the problem. As I asked these questions, I realized, you know, you're actually doing to this theory what people who propose this theory say people do to music.
Yes.
You know?
Right.
Right? So it's like I'm trying to say, okay, let's describe this. Let's, you know, systematize what this is and put it into a category. And in a sense that you're going to want to resist that.
And that's a dialectic between the systems we come up with to understand the world and the world. And that's okay. I don't think anyone's come up with a foolproof system that is transcendentally and eternally relevant. I mean, we're tweaking systems all the time, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I'm bumping my head up against this, and I wonder, am I bumping my head up against this because that's what I do? Like, this is my problem, but this is something that plagues me. Not because, like, I have a particular problem, but this is a philosophical problem that I've run up against so many times, I'm just finding it everywhere. Or is this key to understanding, how do you say his name, Jankelevich's approach to music?
I don't think you're the only person to have a problem with it. I mean, a lot of people have said, well, no, actually, yes, we can use words to get at music, and there's nothing, by insisting on the ineffability of music, we're putting it on a pedestal, which paradoxically allows then people to inflate it with meanings that could potentially be off track or even dangerous. Not that the Nazis were big readers of Jankelevich, but some of the people you read about during the Nazi regime who were very invested in the arts and in music and in trying to demonstrate German superiority in the arts put certain musical works on pedestals and inflated them with they were verbally utterable meanings, but they were meanings that were off track even for anti-Semitic composers who wrote those pieces. And the other big critique about Jankelevich and the reception of his music is that just at a more basic level, it sounds more like idealism when in fact music is a human activity. Kind of drawing on the more anthropological approaches to music, and anyone, the critique would say, anyone who starts talking about music like it's divine or spiritual and stops talking about music as an activity is really leading us in the wrong direction.
But okay, and so now that's important because Jankelevich makes a distinction between actions, music that leads to action or music that is for an activity, as opposed to music that is aimed, that words can aim themselves at to describe. Is that, how do I, anyway, there's an action versus talking kind of distinction, but I'm not sure I quite understand it. Could you explain it to me?
Sure. Sure. I think he's talking about our reaction to music. Should our reaction simply be more words, or should our reaction to music be a drastic action? And he's vague about what that drastic action is. But we could turn that into a more liberational message and say, what could be a drastic action that demystifies music? You could make that drastic action any number of things that are more socially rooted.
Right. So could you concretize that for me a little bit? Like, give me an example of a work of music that has generated both an onslaught of words and then using Jankelevich's approach inspired a drastic action that was a better reaction?
Well, I won't give you an example of a musical work. I'll give you an example of another book about music, but it's a very famous book by Christopher Small. It's called Musicking, and the ing at the end of music, the king, I should say, is underscoring the idea that music is an activity and it's not just an object. This was another important book that came out in the 80s, and just reminded people that as meaningful and as transcendent as music can be to us, it's a human activity, and it's not only a privileged activity of a very small group of performers or composers, but it's people listening as well. And they could be unspecial people. Forgive the crudity of that word, but, you know, not specialists, not professionals, but just, you know, people listening to music as part of their daily lives. So not that Shankelevich would have had any opportunity to talk about this musicking. I'm not even sure if he was still alive when it came out, but I would regard that as an example of a drastic action.
Back to object-oriented ontology for a moment, you know, the two ways that Graham Harman describes the philosopher's approach to an object is to undermine it, which means to describe it or describe its constituent parts, and then, or to overmine it, that is to describe how it fits in the world, what it does in the world. And I guess now it's sounding to me like this approach to musicology is one which tries to describe what music does in the world as a human activity. It's that overmining gesture.
Yeah, that's, I like what, where you're going with this, because what Harman is doing, it is parallel to different approaches that musicologists have taken that actually in turn reflect kind of older work on in semiotics. That in music, you can talk about what the composer intended when he or she wrote something. You can talk about what the listener hears, and then you can talk about this very dodgy third area of the music itself. And this is really the contentious part of the triad, because some musicologists say there is no such thing as the music itself. There is either what we hear or there is what composers intended to put in it, but there is no sort of objective meaning to music. Now, I haven't read enough Harman. I've read only a little bit, but if I understand what you're saying correctly, he says that, you know, humans generally make the mistake of objectifying anything that is not human or not themselves. And object-oriented ontology, one of its goals is to reinvest the object with the... Maybe I'm going too far by saying reinvest the object with subjectivity.
You know, I don't know. That, I think, is probably something that's debated within object-oriented ontology. I think Harman maybe leans towards divesting human beings of subjectivity.
Yeah. Okay.
But I think there's a big debate there. But but go on. Let's take it for granted.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know that there. I guess Harman is pointing towards a third way.
Right.
That's neither a subjective object nor an over objectified object.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, that's where I,
that's where you end. But well, okay. But yeah. So forget about object oriented ontology for a second. But would you just agree that this approach to music might be it sounds a little bit like an ethnomusicologist approach because, you know, you can discover what the truth of the musical work is by discovering what it does in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It ends up, you know, whether it wants to or not, it ends up being very worldly, mundane, cultural. I don't mean mundane in a negative sense. I just mean the world.
Yeah. And so if you were going to talk about a rock song, you're going to talk about, you know, what to find out what it does. Are you going to find, like, you're going to talk about where it's been played, who listens mm-hmm. to it, what kind of products are sold using that kind of music, the history of the rock concert? How are you going to approach understanding a rock song then?
Lots of different ways. What you just said, the history of it, looking at reception. So what have people said about the song over the years? You can also take a very Marxist approach and just talk about the material conditions in which the song was produced. So, you know, from the recording studio to how it was mass marketed, whether the move to digital music has changed the status of the song, or how. I mean, because yes, digital music has changed the status of every single mm-hmm. every single song, but how digitizing music has changed that song. So there are several kind of ways to slice through our understanding of the song. You can take a cultural studies method or a Marxist method, or if you want to be really old school, you can just go back to the positivist. When was it recorded? Who were the personnel on the recording? Anything else you can get positive factual information on.
But where is the ineffable in all that? That seems like we've lost the ineffable now.
Yeah. When you know, certain songs have, I guess a good word would be magical moments. They could be mistakes. They could be flukes. They could be very well planned, but they're moments that seem to attract our attention for whatever reason. They could be really great moments. They could be bad. And it's difficult to talk about those moments because they aren't necessarily something that we expect formally. It's not, they're unpredictable. They jump out at us. They could be something that happens in a live performance.
So that's where the ineffable is the what happens spontaneously then, or independently.
Yeah. I mean, the musicologist Carolyn Abate talks about live performance in opera as being a particular kind of seat of the ineffable, because it's in live performance that unpredictable things happen. But even in a recording, I don't want to get away from recordings. Even in a recording, if there's a special moment that you really, really like in a song, it's hard sometimes to talk about why it's special.
You know, I'm going to tell you an anecdote, and it's one that I feel is perfect because I'm wary of it at the very outset because I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to speak about it very coherently because it is ineffable. But I have seen two cellists in concert. I may have told you this before. I'm not sure. But I went to see Yo-Yo Ma perform, and he was great and energetic and perfect. I mean, I'm not even anyone in a position to judge what's perfect and what isn't, but there's something about the way he performed that made me feel like he was hitting every note exactly right, exactly at the right time. And then I saw Lynn Harrell perform. He's a cellist who's not as well known. And he was about 20 years older than Yo-Yo Ma when I saw Lynn Harrell perform. And he told a story about who had owned his cello before and how she died. So that was probably poisoning the well or something, you know, setting up a reaction. But when I listened to him play, it didn't strike me as perfect, didn't strike me as imperfect, but it was ineffable. There was a beauty to it. There was a quality to it that, I don't know, I was, you know, cliches come to mind, like it spoke to his experience. It spoke, he was speaking his experience and some of his loss and something profoundly human through his music. And I wouldn't imagine that the same piece would have that quality if anyone else had played, and if anyone else had played the same, or if he even had played that piece on a different night, or with a different instrument, or a different point in his life. So I've had the direct experience of that ineffable quality, but at the same time, I sort of want to question it. I mean, there's lots of ways for me to question it. Like, one of them is, hey, Lynn Harrell, middle-aged white guy, who, while I wasn't middle-aged at the time, perfectly positioned for me to think of him as a genius. Okay, you know? Whereas Yo-Yo Ma, Asian guy, perfectly positioned for me to think of him as mathematical. You know? So I want to question just that sort of obviously kind of racist stuff that is unfortunately in my brain. But... and yet I don't want to just throw out the idea that Lynn Harrell really did give not even a superior performance, just an ineffably rich performance. I don't know. So you can, I don't know what you can do with any of that, but, you know, try to talk to the ineffable.
Yeah. I mean, you put your finger on the experience, and we can try the best we can to get at why we have reactions, to different performances or to different pieces of music. And we won't ever quite get there. We can do our best, though. It's good that you're asking those questions, right? I mean, you're at least trying to contextualize your reception. And it could be also, you know, Doug, it could be that you were just feeling more receptive the night that the second cellist performed. It could be that you were starstruck. I mean, Yo-Yo Ma is an institution. So when one goes to a Yo-Yo Ma concert, one expects perfection. So.
Right, right. No, you're right. There's lots of factors there. And yet I wouldn't want to, I feel like I'm being a spoilsport by not just granting Lynn Harrell having created a beautiful, transcendent even moment, you know? And I want to say most everyone in the theater who was worth anything anyway experienced the same thing I did. That's how snobbish it gets, right? So I don't know. So there it is. There's that Eurocentrism or something coming up. I'm not sure what. So anyway, have I killed the conversation with this example, or what do you think?
No, this you know gives us a good place. Of departure for the workshop. And
yeah, it's an interesting challenge, and it's a deep challenge, because no one wants to lose our experience of the world and, you know, our sense of naturalness about our own experiences and our emotions and what we value. But we sort of are the demands of politics and philosophy, you know, is that we sort of lose that. And it's a kind of a crushing blow. Do you want to say that ineffable naturalness of experience?
I think that it pops up whether we want to repress it or not. And that's why music is, you have to search far and wide to find a person who doesn't like some type of music. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, because, you know, just when we think we've understood it all, we have mapped it all out. Some new piece of music comes into our lives and it changes us, and we don't know why at first, and we have to go back and check it out. And it's magic.
And now, Bosley Bendix, cultural reviewer and director of stylistic premonitions for the Universal Media Network, with today's Arts Review.
Good hello, I'm Crosley Bendix, foremost cultural critic and director of stylistic premonitions for the Universal Media Network. And I've been pushed out here to satisfy your insatiable appetite for entertainment for just a little bit longer. Well, I hardly need to be pushed, but you do! My cultural review tonight will not needlessly stoop to criticize the performance you've been witnessing here tonight. I'm sure you don't need me to do that. But from under my new hat, I hear the words old hat coming to mind. And does my mind mind? No, it's way too late for that, or anything else as far as so-called music is concerned. And I'm not talking about this music or that music. No, I'm talking about all music. The whole shebang, the entire kit and caboodle, whatever that is. Yes, every stitch in time, every note and rhyme, every type and kind, all the music that's ever been made by anyone anywhere. The one no longer ignorable fact is that it's all been done before by now, and there is no longer anything truly new that can be achieved in music anymore. Now, of course, the so-called new music is still being predictably pumped out, and it's still being called original. But any fool versed in the whole history of music can hear that there's no longer anything truly original about any of it at all. We have always been accustomed to assuming that there must be plenty of untried musical concepts, styles, structures, sounds, and note combinations left to discover in the future. But think again about that old song. Actually, it's no longer true. I'm suggesting we are now finally past the point of discovering anything possibly new in music that has not already been done to everyone's satisfaction in old music.